are in the second essay of the Kuzari, and we are in paragraph 14, which is on page 89, and I think that we made our way someplace to about page 91, and I'll tell you exactly what he has been saying here. He has been telling us that there's something unique and unusual and exceptional about the land of Israel. He had spoken a number of times about the land, and the king of the Khazars asks him, well, what's so special about your land? So he says, well, you understand that there are different places on the face of this earth that grow different crops in a very special way. He had mentioned him that the mountain where you live is a place where it seems grapes grow in great abundance and very, very exceptional quality of grapes. So too, there's a place that is uniquely divine. And he begins to explain what it's all about. Prophecy, he says, was either in Eretz Yisrael or about Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael is the land of prophecy. Avraham, who was the first prophet, hears the call from God, left with only Eretz Yisrael, in order that he should go to Eretz Yisrael. The whole purpose of God's appearing to him was that he should journey to Eretz Yisrael. Yechezkel and Daniel, that said prophecy in Babylon, were able to do so, number one, because they had already had prophecy in Israel, or their prophecy in Babel was because of Eretz Yisrael. Yonah begins his prophecy in Eretz Yisrael. Yirmiyahu, by the way, most of the years that he was prophet, he prophesied in Israel, but toward the end of his life, he's saying prophecy in Egypt. Here, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has a unique position. He says that Yirmiyahu, in the part of Egypt where he was, just as Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam in the Sinai Desert, the Sinai Desert, he holds as part of the biblical land of Israel. So whatever is taking place, the 40 years in the desert, is really taking place in biblical Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam can say prophecy there. And the same thing was true with Yirmiyahu, when it wasn't that part of its time. He was able to say prophecy. He goes on to describe the fact that the first struggle that led to the first murder in history, Cain killing Hevel, the murder of Cain's murder of Hevel was because they were struggling about Eretz Yisrael. Who would have Eretz Yisrael? That was one. There is a symphony, an absolute cacophonous symphony of cell phones. It's Beethoven, you know, in
turning over in his grave.
Yeah.
Very good.
Jazz.
Turn it off. It sounds more like a rock symphony than Beethoven. So with Beethoven, Michael's mine. I think mine, when mine rings, and I think I have it off, it's better than yours. It's some symphony. Anyway, the first struggle that Yehuda HaLevi says, the first battle between Cain and Hevel was over who would own Eretz Yisrael. The struggle between Yitzchak and Yishmael was over Eretz Yisrael. The struggle between Yaakov and Esau was about Eretz Yisrael. We're talking about the very first battle that was waged on the face of this earth, and so it has continued until today. This city, for example, has changed hands 86 times in history. There is no other city on the face of this earth over which so many battles have been fought. And most probably the most unusual battle of all is the one that's being waged now, because it's no longer a battle as much of bullets. It is of bombs, but it's also a political struggle. We should be able to win it hands down, and for some reason or other that battle is not yet over. So he takes us through history and shows that the struggle was always about this. This is the place where Avram brought his son Yitzchak onto the Akedah. This is where Yaakov said, you'll remember the sentence that they said, "How awful is this place," which of course we would not translate it, "Manora ha-makom hazeh," how awesome is this place. Now we're on page 92, number 15. What he has said is, now you understand that there are places that are uniquely suited for agriculture, and there is a place on the face of this earth that is uniquely suited for the divine presence. So the king says, and really the last thing he had talked about is the four levels of creation. There's the inanimate object, there's that which grows, and then there's that which moves and lives, and then there's man. These are the classifications of the various objects that make up the face of this earth. Number 15, the king of the Kazakh says, these are the general rules of a science which must be classified. This does not concern us now, and I will ask you about it when we speak on the subject. Continue your discussion of the special advantages of the land of Israel. The king seems to be very interested in knowing more about the land of Israel. Now somebody thought that this year was also going to be a Purim year. So there is, of course, a relationship. There's a year that I said years ago. I can do it in 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes. In the Megillah, the classic pasuk of the Megillah is Ishihudi, Hoya B'Shushan Avira. There was a Yehudi in Shushan Avira who Shmo, and his name was Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Yimin. Pasuk goes on to say, Asher Heglotim Hargolah, he was taken into exile with the exile that came in the days of Yechaniah Melech Yehuda. He came yet in the early wave of exiles, Asher Heglah, and who was the one that had exiled him and the others to Babel? Nebuchadnezzar Melech Babel. That's the introduction we're told about Mordechai. Now the Gemara asks, when it says that Mordechai is Ish Yehudi, that means he is from the tribe of Yehuda. At the end of the pasuk, it says he is Ish Yimini, means he is from the tribe of Binyamin. So the Gemara asks, is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? And the Gemara gives a whole series of answers. One is that his mother was from Yehuda and his father was from Binyamin. Because remember, he's from the family of King Saul. King Saul was from the tribe of Binyamin. And then there are other opinions of the Gemara that say that the Yehuda took credit for Mordechai, and Binyamin took credit for Mordechai. Each one say that they influenced him. There's another answer in the Gemara that says that Yehuda blamed Binyamin and blamed Mordechai for all of the sophists that was going on, and then they say Binyamin. I have my own answer. And I like my own answer. Not to the exclusion of all other answers. And it's going to be significant here. When it says, Ish Yehudi Hoya B'Shushan HaBira, there was a Jew in Shushan HaBira. There was a Jew in Shushan HaBira whose name was Mordechai Ben-Yur and Shimi Ben-Kish Yishimi. There were a lot of other Jews in Shushan. Ish Yehudi Hoya B'Shushan. There was a Jew in Shushan. There were thousands, there were tens of thousands of Jews in Shushan. But there was something about Mordechai that was dramatically different than all the rest. He had come yet in the days of the first wave of exiles, even before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And you know what the great power of Mordechai was? He may have been now close to 70 years, he may have been bundled to 70 years. But he was Ish Yehudi, and you know what else he was? Ish Yemini. And I explain Ish Yemini as meaning that he was one of the last Jews in Shushan who remained faithful to the oath that had been taken at the rivers of Babylon in Eshtorchei Yerushalayim, Tishkar, Yemini. He's an Ish Yehudi on one hand, and I once said this to rabbis, the responsibility of rabbis to be on the one hand an Ish Yehudi, you have to bring Yahdut to your people. You have to teach them what Torah is all about. But that's not enough. A rabbi to American rabbis, I said. And I live to tell the tale. Not only must you be Ish Yehudi, in your communities you have to be Ish Yemini. You have to talk about Eretz Yisrael. You have to impress upon your people the significance and the importance of Eretz Yisrael. The end of the story, of course, is the following. After the story, Mordechai goes out from before the king and they list all of the robes of greatness, the raiments of royalty. He has achieved a position of such might, strength, power, prominence over 127 states. You know what he does? He goes on Aliyah. And it seems like I gave up a great job in West Hempstead to go on Aliyah. Do you know what Mordechai gave up in order to go on Aliyah? And there's clear proof that he went on Aliyah. First of all, the Gemara says in one place that one of the people who was with Ezra was Mordechai. And then there is a Rashi in Masechta Menachos that I heard Rabbi Lang say it Sunday night at the dinner for Rabbi Lev. A Gemara in Menachos, when the Gemara talks, Amar Mordechai. Mordechai said, and it's about something that's taking place in the Beit HaMikdash, and Rashi says, which Mordechai? Asher Hayah B'mei Achashverosh, the one that was in the days of Achashverosh. He is now passing in Shalos about the sacrifices of the Beit HaMikdash. Mordechai gave up everything and went to Aliyah. Did I now connect what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say about Eretz Yisrael? I've now connected it to Purim. Let no one make the mistake of thinking that this... Oh, I remember it now. Oh, God. Thank God I don't remember these details because I get aggravated all over again. An essay that was written by Ein Grosser Rabbina some 80, 90 years ago in Europe. And last year, on one of my visits to Toronto, they have a magazine that comes out. I won't tell you from what organization, but a religious organization. They had it reprinted there. And the thrust of the article is that Purim is ein hohes Gottes. And the purpose, right, translate that.
Yeah.
It is an exile Yontif, and he goes on to describe how Purim is rooted in the exile and shows what greatness Jews can achieve in the exile. I'm reading it, I'm getting sicker and sicker. So the Rebbeinu always does this for me. I wasn't going to say it to me. I was attending a wedding that night, and the editor of the magazine is there. I think he regrets that I didn't come to the wedding. I get a hold of him and I say, how in heaven's name did you publish such a nonsense article? Even though it was a great man, there are times that people wrote things that may have been understood at some other time, but certainly are meaningless today. You have to have a little... You have to have a little sensitivity to the covenant of Gedolei Yisrael. There are things that they wrote that should be forgotten. You have to raise it all the time. So he tells me, oh, I don't read all the articles that I put in today. So I say, this is an editor. This is an editor. Unbelievable. Das große Yontif in das Gulas, the great Yontif of the Gulas, that's what it was all about. I mean, obviously it was a Jew of German extraction, by the way, it was not Chancellor of Welsh. Even though his approach to Eretz was also a radical one. He was not in favor of the movement of Shivat Zion that started in Europe, but before the Zionists, by the way, the Zionist movement started at the end of the 19th century. 30, 40, 50 years earlier, there were Gedolei Yisrael who were calling on Jews to begin the return. And that came out 70, 80 years after the students, at the end of the 18th century, right around 1776, either 75 or 76, before July 4th or after July 4th. I don't remember whether Washington was in Valley Forge or not, but just around that time, the students of the Vilna Gaon and the students of the Baal Shem Tov were sent by their respective leaders. It was probably the only thing that Hasidim and Mishnayim ever agreed on, and I'm talking about the students of the Vilna Gaon and the students of the Baal Shem Tov made their way to Eretz Yisrael. Both the Gaon and the Baal Shem attempted the journey themselves, and on both of them there are stories that at some point in the journey they have to go back. They couldn't make it. I mean, there's so much written about, you know, Min HaShemayim. They stopped them, but their students made it, and the fact is that they established communities in Tzfat and in Yerushalayim. There's a lot of places, and they were really the beginnings of modern Zionism, of the students of the Baal Shem and the students of the Vilna Gaon. And certainly in the middle of the 18th century, in the middle of the 19th century, it was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and others who really began the move to come. And they had invited Rav Chantal of Goldhirsch to join them in this effort to speak to Jews about coming. And Rav Chantal of Goldhirsch did not want to join. Because he felt that there's a major task for the Jewish people to be exiled, and I'm certain that would he have lived to see the Holocaust, he would have changed his mind radically. He was still living at a time where to be a German Jew was, you know, to be something of great significance. And when I hear Talmidim of his today who quote what he said then and don't begin to realize that he would certainly not have advocated the same thing today is simply not an understanding of what a position taken by a Golden Sermon at a particularly long in history means. Yes?
Rabbi, how do we know that Rev Hirsch didn't want to, so to speak, abandon Germany to reform Judaism?
There may very well be so. Yeah. By the way, I'm ready to listen to any kind of Limon's course. He felt it was a test. By the way, that's why you can't ask a question on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein or the Lubavitcher Rebbe or even our salvation. What are you talking about? What would American Jewry have been without those three? Those three giants are the ones that maintained whatever Yiddish country there is in the United States. On the contrary, I hold that it was a sacrifice to their part. We even now have a letter that our salvation wrote in 1967, in which he said that he planned at that point to spend half a year in Eretz Yisrael. This is related to Purim. There was a woman who had sent him a letter asking why he doesn't live in Eretz Yisrael. So he sends all his years. See, this is always, this could be related to the because we have no idea. So he sent back, it was a young woman. Young woman. Wife, late wife of one of the Rabbanim of Yesharot, the Neil Shiloh, Miriam Shiloh Alashom, she died young. She sent a letter for her salvation asking why he doesn't come Aliyah. The response was so beautiful. He says, "You're right. I accept your admonition. You're right. And you should know that last year my wife and I had decided that we would spend half a year in Eretz Yisrael and half a year in the United States. But our plans changed. On Tainus Esther, my wife passed away. Predecessor of 67, I think, or 68. That was the great tragedy in Rav Soloveitchik's lifetime. After that, he was not capable anymore of. There is Mishnurim where he describes what he went through after the passing of his wife. Mount Kephasis, yes. A number of places where he talks about what he went through with fear, the agony of Avelis. That's why the Rav became one of the great posting in the whole area of mourning. Anyway, what is Mordechai? Mordechai did leave everything and went on Aliyah. So here it is, the king of the Kazakh said, listen, whatever else we have to discuss, let's leave that for later. Whatever you want to talk about the structure of the whole world, let's leave about it. I want to hear more about what you have to say about Eretz Yisrael. So, number 16 on page 92. Let me just get my... It was appointed to rabbi, number 16. It was appointed, not as much appointed as it, that land was destined. God destined that land to guide the world. More than that, to straighten out, to correct the world. In other words, that at some point in time, instruction is going to go. King Zion takes a Torah with Barashev Yishai. There are great messages that are going to come out to the world from this land. By the way, there's no question about it, but that has already happened many times in history, and we look forward to the day when Hashem Lemelech HaKol HaOres, God will be king of the whole world. God is going to ascend the mountain of Tzion in order to judge the rest of the world. And he said that it was apportioned to the tribe of Israel from the time of the confusion of the languages, from the Dor HaTzvagah that we talk about in Parashat Noah, when the Most High divided amongst the nations their inheritance. This land was set aside to be the land of the Jewish people. Abraham was not fit to gain the divine influence and to enter into a mutual compact until he had inherited, so made the covenant with him between the pieces. The Brit Bein HaBitachin, the eternal covenant between God and Abraham, could only take place there, no other place. Now, what is your opinion of a select community which has merited the name the people of God, and also a special name called Nachalat Hashem, the inheritance of God, and of the seasons fixed by Him, not merely agreed upon or settled by astronomical calculations, and therefore styled feasts of the land? He says there are Moadim, there are Yom Tovim that are rooted in the land. And there are all sorts of rules regarding purity and worship, prayers and performances are fixed by God, and they are the work of God and the service of the Lord, and it all takes place only in that land. You can't do it anyplace else. You can't bring sacrifices anyplace else. And we've talked a number of times in the past about the idea that Yom Tov and the calendar had to be established in Yerushalayim. It could not be established outside of Eretz Yisrael. That means everything about around which Torah revolves can only have taken place there. In number 18, he says, take a look, the land even has mitzvot that are related to the land. There's Shabbat Haaretz, there's Shemitah. 19, and the first few sentences in 20, and you'll see where the international date line comes in. The king says in 19, was not the day primarily calculated as dawning first in China, because it forms the eastern commencement of the inhabited earth? The Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Halevi, had left him with the impression that the sanctity of Shabbos begins in Eretz Yisrael. So he says, what do you mean it begins in Eretz Yisrael? It starts in China. That's the East. Now in Hebrew it sounds a little bit better, because the king says the day starts in Sin. I'm not thinking of as I am. Wait. And the Chavar is going to tell him, not in Sin, in Sinai. Shabbos was given to the Jewish people in Sinai. Now there is the next long piece is the great work on the international or the Torah deadline, not the international deadline. Where is East? Where did Shabbos begin? Where was the first moment of which Shabbos appeared on the face of this earth? And this is a landmark piece of work that you have your homework to read about. Where does the day begin? And it's a shaila that you have to know. If you're going to go to Hawaii, you have to talk to your local Orthodox rabbi, you understand? You have to know exactly what to do. So now you take a look, number 20. Take a look. 20 takes you through page 94, 95, 96, 97, top of 98. That's all going to be the discussion of the daytime, which is mamish, an absolutely unusual piece that is written by Rabbi Halevi, and until today, nobody can begin to write or talk or study about the dateline without beginning. Every discussion begins with the Kusari. And then he's going to give us a picture of the whole world. By the way, it's going to be a picture of the world that's going to come from somebody who could not have been sure that the world was round. He knows that he's dealing with two sides to the world, But the other side can be flat, it can be all water, you can drop off into oblivion over there, but he still knows, and he talks about the sun going around the earth, but that we know that Rav Yehuda HaLevi knew the sun doesn't go around the earth, because the Gemara already says that it's the earth that rotates on its axis, it's not the sun going around the earth. But alright, I say that, we're leaving, you're going to have to do the homework. There's going to be a major test, a written test on the Now, I'm going to have to say that if I make it sound like a broken record, but there are simply things that are not translated correctly. Number 21, he says, let me hear what the rabbi said about Eretz Yisrael. Tell me, let me hear some of their observations. The rabbi, here comes piece number one. I marked off at least 9 different statements of our rabbis that are going to be compressed into this one statement. One sentence is, all roads lead up to Palestine, but none from it. Don't read it here in Hebrew. It's not a correct translation. Hakol Malin Leres, so it's a Mishnah. Hakol Malin, all can bring others up to Eretz Israel, Ve'ein Hakol Mohidin, and not everyone can bring people down. And now he's going to explain what he's talking about. Husband or wife can coerce one another to go on Aliyah. But nobody can coerce anybody to go on Yedidah. If a wife decides she wants to go on Aliyah, and the husband doesn't want to go, she can bring him to Besdin, and Besdin will hear what she has to say, and they make her own custom that she go on Aliyah. If he doesn't want to go over Aliyah, he's going to have to pay her super in full, give her a get, and let her go on Aliyah. Usually, when I stay on this mission, I say, a husband can coerce his wife. Then, of course, everybody starts, what do you mean? What do you mean? Husband? So you should know how often it is, husband or wife. So to stay safe and not to be attacked, I started off by talking about a woman who wants to coerce her husband to go on Aliyah. And this is a fact, the halacha. And the halacha applies until fit, except you need a good besdin. Because besdin has to be wise enough to see, does she really need it, or is she using it as a way to hurt her husband?
Yeah, but is that the opposite truth?
Which opposite?
If he decides.
Didn't I just say
no,
that?
No, but you just said, like, then you reverted to the woman thing.
Oh, no. So obviously it's not enough with me now. It's quite clear that I mean whatever halacha applies equally to husband or wife. If a husband says he wants to go on Aliyah, Besdin is going to have to make sure that his intentions are pure and honest, and he's not doing this because he wants to get rid of a burdensome wife. Okay? Did I clear all that? So very good.
Now you said you need a good Besdin.
Huh?
You need a good Beit Din.
Yes.
You need a good Beit Din because if a woman comes before them and demands to go on Aliyah, they are threatened that perhaps their lives will come along and say the same thing if they give her a stop that she can do.
Let's read what he says. You need to take a look at what he says concerning a woman who refuses to go there with her husband. It's the same husband who refuses to go with his wife. she is divorced, and forfeits her marriage settlement. In other words, if the husband doesn't want to go, he has to pay her whole super never again. If the wife doesn't want to go, she forfeits her whole super. On the other hand, if the husband refuses to accompany his wife to Eretz Yisrael, he is bound to divorce her and pay her seven. We now have both sides, okay? Very good. Now, further than Rabbi said, it is better to dwell in the Holy Land, even in a town mostly inhabited by heathens, than abroad in a town chiefly populated by Israelites. That's a very fascinating Gemara. La olam yodur odom b'Eretz Yisrael, a person to live in Eretz Yisrael, v'ir sherubo goyim, even in a city where most are goyim rather than live, in a completely Jewish city in Chutz Lars.
Huh? Hebron.
Hebron is a very classic example. So, in other words, if it's Hebron or Mansi, one can choose Hebron or Mansi. It's clear. It's clear. The Gemara says yes.
And we don't have to worry about the demography.
All right. But the reason the Gemara says, Shekhar Dor Eretz Yisrael, whoever lives in Eretz Yisrael, is considered like one who hasn't God. And one who lives in Chutz La'aretz is considered like somebody who doesn't have a God. You understand what a powerful, powerful statement of the rabbis this is? Very powerful statement. And how do we know this?
It's more powerful.
Yes, how do we know this? Because when David has to flee from before Shaul, and he ends up someplace down in Plishtim, so he says, Ki gerishuni hayom, they have cast me out today, and they've told me, go and worship other gods. Who told David to worship other gods? David felt, because he's living, he had to be for a period of time someplace out of Eretz Yisrael, he felt that to him, this was just like idolatry. Thus says David, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Which means that he who dwells abroad is as if he served strange, gods. In Egypt, and by the way, he was living in Egypt, down someplace in Sinai. If Egypt, with regard to which a covenant was made, is a forbidden land, other countries are still more so. Another saying is, to be buried in Eretz Yisrael is like being buried beneath the altar of the Beit HaMikdash itself. It's a big source to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. But wait a minute.
Yeah.
But wait a minute, that's not the whole story. There would be greater praise for one who came during his lifetime than there was for the one who was brought to Eretz Yisrael after he died. They praised him who is in the land more than him who was carried there dead. And this is expressed by our rabbis in this way. He who embraces it when alive is not like him who does so after his death. The one who really the term of the Gemara is kolatito mechayim. If the land absorbs him while he is alive, is far greater than the one who is that happens after his death. There's also quite a negative comment about somebody who could have lived in Eretz Yisrael his lifetime and chose not to. And then, of course, you see a sign, Arono Yagia Tisat El Al, the casket is going to arrive by El Al, but he could have lived there during his lifetime, he chose not to. About him, there's a pasuk that says, why have you come and you have defiled my land? Why have you come and defiled my land? In other words, you come after death, but you didn't come during your lifetime. Why you lived? You made my inheritance an abomination, my nakala, my land was an abomination. But in death, you come and contaminate my country. And here's a, if you want to hear a real right-wing extremist expression by one of the rabbis. It's told that Rav Hananya, when asked whether it was lawful for a person to go abroad in order to marry the widow of his brother, it's unbelievable. This person came to Rav Hananya and says, my brother in Babel died without children. Now I have a responsibility as a brother-in-law to marry my sister-in-law, a halacha of Yibum. So Rav Hananya said the following: his brother married a pagan woman. Praise be God who caused him to die. Now this one follows him. No one he considered the brother who lived in Eretz Yisrael a god, and the sister-in-law is a shiksa, and he deserves, you know. Very, very sharp statement. Very sharp statement. Maybe they're even sharper statements. And he doesn't pray. I've quoted a number of times. Resh Lakish, an Amora of the third century, who meets up with Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, who lived in Babel. I think they met up in the Jordan, and Resh Lakish says to him, Elohor, I swear to God, Saminal, who I hate you Babylonians, because he didn't come on Aliyah in the days of Ezra. There are those who explain the Gemara, Elohim means God. So it can either mean I swear by God, or Resh Lakish said to him, Elohim Saminal, God hates you Babylonians that you did not come up in the days of Ezra. I mean, that's of course a doomsday tomorrow, when I have nothing left to say to a crowd in Chutzlars. I say that. I never said it. Because I didn't have to. Alright. He goes on to say, the sages also forbade selling the estates or the remains of a house to a heathen. This is very important. In Eretz Yisrael, the halacha is, you can't sell a piece of land to a guy. You can't sell a house to a guy. Certainly can't give it away. So I know what you're thinking about. So what are we doing, Shemitah? We big Zionists, you understand. We go ahead and sell the land to, what's his name?
Jabbar.
From the Renaissance Hotel, who lives in Abu Ghosh. So of course, the cook wrote it and everybody wrote it. When you're selling it, there is a soil, a temporary sale, in order to make it possible for Jews to live in Eretz Yisrael, that's permitted.
Also not a
heathen. Huh?
Not a heathen.
That's another very good point. To Yishmaelim, she said, you're not allowed to sell to a goy. Who falls into the category of goy? Does goy mean idolater? And if so, Muslims don't fall into the category religiously as heathens. So that's also a question that is dealt with. And furthermore, he says, the atmosphere of the Holy Land, fines can only be imposed on the land itself. There are a whole series of fines that Torah talks about. In other words, the full impact of halacha can only take place in Eretz Yisrael. A lot of things you can't do outside. No slave must be transported aboard. You can't. You know, you're talking about a husband and a wife. What happens if an owner of slaves is going to Chutz Lawrence? He can't take a slave with him. Slave can say, you have to free me. You can't take anybody out of Eretz Yisrael. And then it says, the atmosphere of the Holy Land makes wine. Avira de Eretz Yisrael, the avir, the air of Eretz Yisrael, makes wise. By the way, that's the Maimon Chazal that I have the most difficulty understanding today. The most difficult. And I honestly believe that the rabbis were right, and maybe Aviva Be'eretz Yisrael, the air of Eretz Yisrael, makes one wise if he is one who appreciates and understands the meaning of Eretz Yisrael. But the moment that he has lost the sense of the value of Eretz Yisrael, then you know what happens then? Becomes a fool. Becomes a fool. That's what we're watching before our very eyes. The moment we lose the sense of what God has given us here, then you can make terrible, terrible mistakes. All right, let's go for further. They express their love of the land as follows. He who walks 4 cubits in the land is assured of happiness in the world to come. He is promised that he has a sharing world to come. Rabbi Steyr is said to a heathen who criticized his foolhardiness in crossing the river without waiting to reach a ford. Fjord. Rabbi Steyr came out of the yard. And Rabbi Steyr was always a fascinating character in my house. And I'll tell you why. The Gemara says that Rav Zera lived in Babel and his Rebbe was Rebbe Yehuda. And Rebbe Yehuda was opposed to people going on Aliyah. The Gemara says about Rav Zera, that Rav Zera, when he decided he wants to go on Aliyah, he stayed out of his Rebbe's way. So that he shouldn't have to be confronted by his Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda, who tells him, don't go on Aliyah. We'll talk about Rabbi Yehuda in a minute. He's very fascinating. So I remember when I had a similar problem, the Lubavitcher Rebbe told me not to go on Aliyah. So what was I going to do? I wanted to go. So I then made an appointment that flew to Toronto. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was in Toronto at the time. And I went there, so Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, what should I do? The Rebbe tells me not to go, but I want to go. So he says, listen, Gaon Yisrael told you not to go, you know, you can't just take the words of the Gaon Yisrael lightly. So I told him, listen, I'll write him another letter, and I'll explain to him how badly I want to go. So he says, I don't know if I would advise you to do that, because if the Rebbe is going to tell you for a second time not to go on Aliyah, don't ever dream of setting foot in Eretz Yisrael in your lifetime. That scared the wits out of me. So I told him, you know, because he told you, so I said, what are you talking about? Rebbe, I don't know what you're talking about. Rav Zera has a Rebbe Yehuda. And Rav Zera knows that his Rebbe is opposed to him going on Aliyah. And he goes anyway. So he left. And he said, hey, Shalom, Rav Zera hat nicht gefragt, Rebbe Yehuda. Rav Zera didn't ask Rebbe Yehuda, but you asked the Rebbe. That was your first mistake. The truth is, I didn't ask the Rebbe. I really had asked for a bracha. So, remember, I told this story over to my mother-in-law, because I was in Toronto at the time, so I went up to Toronto the day earlier. She always asked me, and she kept asking me, what happened to Rav Zera when he finally came on the yard? Did he make it? Did he get a good job? Did he have a parnasa? So you should know, whenever I learn Gemara and I come to Rav Zera, I'm collecting data on Rav Zera. And here we have this Gemara of Rav Zera. Rav Zera, when he finally comes to the Yarden, he didn't wait for a boat to take him across the Yarden. You know what he did? He jumped into the waters and walked across the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael. So there was a Gentile, a Hebrew there, who said to him, what, you Jews, you're such a hasty bunch of people. What, you can't wait until the next ferry is going to come and take you across the Jordan? So Rabbi Zera said to him, the place where Moshe and Aaron could not enter. And I have this chus, I'm not taking a chance. I'm going straight across that yard. That was Rav Zera. Number 23 is very important in the beginning of and I'm not going to rush it. In number 23, the king goes to work on Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. I tell you, this is a classic in literature. So the king says, if this be so, you fall short of the duty laid down in your law by not endeavoring to reach that place and making it thy abode in life and death. What do you say to him? If so, you say that it's such a big mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, it's the greatest place. And you're saying, well, what are you doing here? You're in Spain, what are you doing here? And not only that, you know what you people say? Have mercy on Zion, for it is the house of our life. In the brachas after the Torah, Rachem al Zion ki hi beit chayenu. Have mercy on Zion, because it's the house of our life. The only place we live is there. So you know what? You say this. And you don't really mean it. Have mercy on Zion. And you believe that the Shia is going to return there? They are sitting in Spain. And had it no other preference, the king tells them, if the only thing that Eretz Yisrael ever had is that the divine presence once was there, even if it wouldn't be there now, that's already reason enough to choose Eretz Yisrael over any other place on the face of this earth. And had it no other preference than that the Shina dwelt there 500 years, this is sufficient reason for men's souls to retire thither, meaning to go there and find purification there, as happens near the abodes of the pious of the prophets and others. It's a model. Kadosh! That's where you should be. Is it not the gate of heaven? I mean, this guy's become, that's the worst. When you turn a guy into a Zionist, he becomes already an extremist. So now the king is getting hot under the collar, and he says, isn't that the place that Yaakov called Shar HaShemayim, the very gate of heaven? All nations agree on that point. Every nation in the world holds that the Eretz Yisrael is the Holy Land. Christians believe that the souls are gathered there and then lifted up to heaven. Islam teaches that it is the place of the ascent. El Burak. The street leading to the Kotel was called El Burak. Burak was the name of the horse on which Mohammed ascended heavenward. You understand? Everybody has a piece of the rock, you understand? A piece of the rock. And the prophets are caused to ascend from there to heaven. And further, that it is the place of gathering on the day of the resurrection. Chias HaRais is the beginning here. Everybody turns to it in prayer and visits it in pilgrimage. Muslims come here. Christians come here. Jews don't come on pilgrimage. They come on presidential missions to save Israel, you understand? Okay? But I'm getting a little bad too already today. But if I say I'm guilty of it too, every time I wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, so I had to tell my wife, she took care of all the little kids. I didn't go that often. She tells me now that during our married life, I went every year. If I didn't go every year, I went at least twice a year. I came to Eretz Yisrael. And the few times that I did come, I said, it's a conference and we're going to be dealing with extremely significant and important matters to plot this level. Did I even talk them into it? This tremendous thing. But we had this feeling of great importance, and I met with Mr. Begin, and I met with Mr. Eshkol. Oh, God. Didn't find out, so yeah. Now it's
came to the young Israel rabbi, I was there.
Yes, you were there. Yes, I came to the Israel rabbi.
Were brought onto the carpet, mercilessly.
Mercilessly.
But I stuck up for
you. You stuck up for me? I thought everybody was opposed to me.
Everybody,
I spoke,
not me.
I made a terrible mistake. I was there on sabbatical, and I spoke at a conference about the centrality of Eretz Yisrael. So they take a look at this guy from New York, and they were right. By the way, they were absolutely right. 12 months later, I was here. That was a rare step. Anyway, let's go further. The bowing and kneeling in the direction of it is either mere appearances or false worship. So he says, you know what? You make all the shuls facing Yerushalayim, and you bow toward Yerushalayim. You know what it all is? It's all phony. Do you know you're a phony? That's what the king is saying. You're a phony. Yet your forefathers are wrong. Yitzchak and Yaakov wanted to live only there or be buried there. Now you talk, big talk about how important Eretz Yisrael is, and you're sitting over there. And you know when the others wanted to live here? Even at a time when there was no divine presence and there was no Beit HaMikdash, they chose to be here, and certainly they were the minority, overwhelming number of barbarians living in the country. This they did even at the time when the Shul was yet visible, but the country was full of unchastity, impurity, and idolatry. Your fathers, however, had no other desire than to remain in it. They only wanted to be here. Neither did they leave it in times of dirt and famine except by God's mercy. Finally, they directed that their bones be brought out. Yaakov said, don't bury me in Mitzrayim, take me out there. So this is quite an assault on the Chavir, the Tamchah. His response. And I'm sorry, the response, I first learned the response in the early translation of the, into Hebrew, of the Kuzri. And I'll never forget it. Ho vashtani melech kuzar. You have embarrassed me, king of the Kuzar. That's much better than, this is a severe reproach. Ho vashtani melech kuzar. In other words, he didn't start telling him, listen, no, let's call spade a spade. I give $100 a year to UJA, understand? Next time I have a chance to go on a mission, I'm going to call a mission, you can't tell the honesty of Rav Yehuda Halevi. In the new translation, he says, Ochein motzoto mikum cherpati melech kuzar. You have found the place of my shame, king of the Kazar. Oh, that's good. This is a severe approach. You know what it is? It's an honest. And he's going to go on to say that this is the sin that we've been committing for so long. And you know, he's really going to be reiterating that which Rish Lakish said. We didn't come in the days of Ezra. Would we have come en masse in the days of Ezra? Would we have left Babel? Jewish history would have been dramatically different. And then Rav Yehuda Halevi is going to make another extremely honest statement. In addition to the fact that he said that this has been our problem all along, he says that was the problem in Babel. Shalom yochlu leiparei, they could not leave. Mishkinotehem, v'inotehem. They couldn't leave their homes and their businesses. That's an honest statement. Not hiding behind, what are you talking about? How can I go on here? I'm going to have the proper chinuch for my children, the kind that I can have over here at the yard. You can get as many drugs as you want in any school. I mean, take a chance then to a place where there may not be drugs. Like they think that the only place you can educate children is there. You can't educate. No, I'm going to make a print house over there. Or the old silly joke, how do you make a small fortune? You come to Israel with a big fortune. It becomes a small fortune. Silly jokes. If you're not lazy, it's brutally honest. Hovashtani Melech Kuzar, King of the Khazars, you have embarrassed me. You found the place of my shame, and this has been our problem all along. We'll continue next week.